29th, the 40th day of the Omer. And we are on page 264 in Parshas Vayigash in our creation series. Pasuk Yud Aleph, verse 11.
264.
Vayoshev Yosef es aviv ve'esechov. And Yosef settled his father and his brothers. Va'itein lohem achuza be'eretz Mitzrayim. He gave them a
possession.
Okay, good. A possession, something to hold on to in the land of Egypt. B'meitav ha'aretz, in the best of the land. Be'eretz Ramesses, in the land of Ramesses. Kasher tziva faro, as Paro had commanded. Va'yichalkel Yosef es aviv ve'esechav ve'es kol beis aviv. Lechem lefi hataf. And Yosef provided for his father and for his brothers and for the entire household of his father bread according to the children. So let's stop here for a moment. Let's analyze these two psukim, because starting with Yud-Gimel 13, at least according to Rashi, we launch into a different discussion. So first of all, the brothers had said to Paro, which we read two shiurim ago, and we read it in the Haggadah. They say to Paro, one page back on page 262, Pasuk Dalet verse 4, Vayomu el Paro lagur ba'aretz banu, which means
sojourn.
Right. They've come to sojourn in the land. Not to live, but to be here for a short time. On the other hand, Paro had said to Yosef, back when Yosef revealed who he was, and Paro asked Yosef to go bring his father down. So his language is, back on page 254. I'm sorry, that's too far back. It is what Paro said to Yosef, but that not over there. That's a different discussion. I apologize. It's closer to where we are now. Paro says to Yosef, we're still just on page 262, the same page we looked at what the brothers said. Paro then says to Yosef in Pasuk Hey, verse 5, Eretz Mitzrayim ufanecha, he, the land of Mitzrayim, is in front of you. B'meitav ha'aretz, in the best of the land, hoshev es avicha ve'esachecha. Have your father and your brothers settle them. Yeshvu be'eretz Goshen, they should settle in the land of Goshen. So Paro clearly wants some permanence. Mm-hmm. He wants Yosef's family to remain in Mitzrayim, and on a permanent basis, the brothers are saying they want to go only temporarily. Agur ba'aretz. And here, it says that Yosef did it in a more permanent way, using the word shave, vayoshev, back on page 264, vayoshev Yosef, es aviv es achav, and Yosef settled his father and his brothers. So the Ramban says that was Yosef deliberately trying to go against his brothers' and father's wishes? So the Ramban says that they could do as they pleased, meaning would they remain permanently or would they be just sojourning in the land? But there is a difference between the way that you help a new family in town if they're only coming for a couple of months, or if they're coming for the long haul. If they're only coming for a couple of months, so then you don't need to get them housing that will meet their needs so well. So it'll meet their needs, it'll be all right. They can last for a couple of months with adequate housing. You don't need to do something that's going to take care of them for in the best possible way. You don't need housing that will remain available for a long period of time. Even if it's only available for 2-3 months, that's all right, because they're leaving anyway. You don't need to plan long term.
Why would they say they are leaving when they know that they're probably here because of the
good
bris between Hashem and Abraham?
Good. So what would you say to that?
Well, they don't maybe know they long.
Well, they know it's not short.
I mean, so what does that mean?
I mean, they know it's going to be the
they know years.
Well, it was 400 years. They were told 400 years. Arba Me'eo Shana. Now it happens to be the 400 years that counted from the birth of Yitzchak, so it only ends up being 210 years. But 210 years is it's a long time.
So you don't want to say they don't want it to appear to give the impression.
Why?
Coming to settle because they ultimately don't want to settle.
Okay, so they want to
make sure that they won't go back to Israel.
Okay, so it's similar to the way that we should be in any country that we're in, whether it's America, whether it's any other country, including Israel. Our feeling should be that we are only temporary because we are not in Geula. We are not redeemed. We are in Gullus. Even living in Israel, one is in Gullus. One is in exile right now. And we should not have a sense of permanence to whatever situation we're in. And that's the famous story that the Chafetz Chaim, who was always looking, always anticipating the coming of Mashiach, and allegedly he had a suitcase always packed, ready to go, should Mashiach appear on the scene. And that's the way we should be living as well. The brothers, their point was not, should it be, how should the housing look, how should their point was, we may be physically here in Egypt, but we're focused elsewhere. And the first possible moment, we're back to Eretz Yisrael, Eretz Canaan. That's the way they're focused. So, but Yosef, in setting them up, he gives them treatment based on their being there long term. So he gives them housing that would last them. He gives them land that will last them. It's more than just the physical setup. It's also, in many ways, psychological. When someone is only going to be in town for a few months, you don't invest in that person. You know, you're friendly with the person, of course. You're cordial with the person. But you don't invest in that person, not because you have anything against them, but because you don't want
to
invest. What's the point? The person's leaving anyway. It's not easy when a good friend of yours moves away. So why would you invest and become very friendly with someone who's only here for a couple of months when you know they're leaving anyway? It's only going to hurt when they leave. And you don't encourage your children to be very close friends, not because you have anything against them, but because why set up a situation which is only going to end up in pain or whatever. So it's not the kind of thing that a person invests in. When you know they're going to be here a long time, or you hope they're going to be here for a long time, then you invest in them. So Yosef treated them like people who are planning on being in town for many years, which in fact was the case. But in their minds, they're elsewhere. Yeah, you had a question?
It's not on this topic, but you mentioned that, for example, the Prophet's son allegedly had a suitcase back with Mashiach. What is the point of going to where Mashiach comes? Isn't Mashiach going to save the whole world? I mean, why is it that we have to go to where he is?
We're going to want to, but I don't want to get sidetracked. Okay. So, so he settles them in a more permanent way. Now it says in Pasuk Yud Aleph, verse 11, "B'meitav ha'aretz, in the best of the land, Beretz Rameses." Now I want to show you a subtlety in the Hebrew language, which is not well known. Looking around the room, okay, I don't want to put anybody in this spot. There may be one or two people here who are very familiar with the rules of Shvana and Shvanach. If you're not, don't worry. If you don't even know what those terms mean, don't worry. But I want to show you a subtlety in the language over here. You notice that, let's not use that word, let's use a different word, which is easier to deal with. I'm still looking in the same pasuk, the same verse, but you need to look in the Hebrew side for this. Look in the word Be'eretz Mitzrayim. Be'eretz Mitzrayim, in the land of Mitzrayim. Mm-hmm. Now, underneath the bays of Be'eretz, the vowel under the bays is a Sheva. Mm-hmm. Sheva is the two dots going down. Now, we say that that is pronounced roughly as the English letter I, the short sound, I,
right.
Be'eretz. That vowel sound is actually not a sound. It actually indicates whether a syllable is starting or is not starting, or is ending. Either it's the start of a syllable or it's the end of a syllable. When you see that vowel, obviously in the beginning of the word, it has to be the start of a syllable. But in other places, it's the end of a syllable. And let me show you one. Let me see if I can find one in this pasuk.
Like paro.
Like paro. That's correct. Thank you. Look at the very last word. You were the one who I thought knew about shvana shvana. Yeah. Look at the very. Pick me, that was good. Look at the very end of the pasuk. The last word in the pasuk is paro. Actually, here it's faro.
Yeah.
So there's a shva under the resh. So it's faro. The shva indicates that it's the end of the syllable. Now you don't say fareo. That one you don't say is an I sound. When it's under the base of be'eretz, you say be'eretz. But under the resh of paro, you don't say pareo. You say paro. Because there it indicates the end of the syllable rather than the beginning of the syllable. So when it indicates the end of the syllable, it's not enunciated. When it indicates the beginning of a syllable, then it is enunciated. Which is a funny thing because it's the same symbol for both the beginning and end of a syllable. So there are rules for whether it is a shiva na. Na means to move. That's the word nun ayin, means to move. Whether the name of the vowel is shiva. Is it a moving shiva, which means it's starting a syllable? Or is it a shiva nach, nach from like noach, to rest? It is the end of a syllable. There are rules for this. And there are various rules. I'm not going to drag you through that over here, even though it is a topic that I enjoy talking about, but not, I will not do that to you. That would be bait and switch. It is not a grammar class. However, clearly, in the word be'eretz, when a shva comes in the beginning of a word, it clearly has to be a shva, not a moving shva, it's starting the syllable. That's obvious. Now, look at the word rameses. Now, before we discuss the shvas in that word, look carefully at the spelling of rameses, resh, ayin, mem, samach, samach, and look at the vowels. You have a patach and a under the resh.
Two shivas.
I'm sorry. No, pasuk yud aleph. Same pasuk. 11.
Next to the yud beis.
First word. So you have a patach under the resh. You have two shivas, one under the ayin, one under the mem, and under the samach you have a tsere, the a sound, rameses. Now hold this place, and we're going to now turn to the more famous use of the same word. This is the way it's used in the Chumash in a few places, but the one that most everyone is familiar with is in the beginning of Parashat Shemos, which is the cities that the Jewish people built when they were slaves in Egypt. Turn to page 294. That's correct. Also from the Haggadah. It is pasuk Yud Aleph, verse 11. Also it's the top pasuk, the first pasuk on the page, right? So it says they built Ari Miskenos to Pharaoh. They built storehouse cities for Paro, as Pisom ves Ramses. Pisom and Ramses. Now, Ramses over there is spelled exactly the same. Resh, Ayin, Mem, Samach, Samach. And the vowels are nearly the same. There's a patach under the Resh, Da. Under the Ayin, there's a patach, an A.
Should be a Shvana.
Well, over there was a Shva. Here, under the mem is also a shiva, and on the samach there is a tzere. So everything is the same, except that under the ayin here is a patach and a sound, while before it was a shiva. Now this means that there's going to be two differences in the way that you pronounce the word on page 294, and the word where we are on page 264. The one on page 294 is easier. Let's look at 294. There, how do you say? You say ra-am-ses. The shiva is a shiva nach. It ends the syllable. It's ra am seis.
Right.
Ra am seis. That's how you pronounce it. Ra am seis. On page 64 where we are, there, the rule of thumb is, whenever you have two shivas in a row, the first shiva is a shiva nach, which means it does not make a sound, it ends the previous syllable. Mm. And the second shiva is always a shiva na, it starts a syllable. Think about it. If you just ended the previous syllable, you must start the next syllable. Mm. So when you have two shivas in a row, the first one has to end a syllable, the second one has to start a syllable. And therefore, the way you pronounce it on page 264 is ra-me-ses. Ra-me-ses. So the two differences are that the ayin does not have a patach, so on 264 you're not going to say ra-a. It's not two a's in a row. Right. And second of all, under the mem, the shiva is now a shiva na. It's a moving shva because it's starting the next syllable, mm-hmm. and it gets pronounced rameses. Whereas on 294, it's ra'amses. Now this is obviously a very, very subtle difference. Mm-hmm. And when you're saying it fast, you're not going to hear it. The question is, are these two places the same place or not? Mm-hmm. One would have assumed that they must be the same place. It's the same word. The difficulty with saying they're the same place is the Jews lived in Ramesses. How could they then have built these cities of, what are they called? Storage cities for Paro called Pisom and Ramses. As a result of this question, and the fact that the vowels are slightly different, there are those, including the Ibn Ezra, who say that they are in fact two different places. Now they may have been very close to each other. One may have been a suburb of the other. It's very strange they have the same name. But one is Ra'amses, that's the one they built. And one is Ra'meses, that's the one they lived in. Mm-hmm. And it's different. According to this understanding, if the Baal Kriya, the one who reads from the Torah on Shabbos, doesn't pronounce it correctly, he would have to repeat it, because he'd be saying the wrong place. It'd be like saying New York or Newark. Newark or New York. When you're on the train, on the Amtrak train, they're very careful to say Newark. Newark. New York. Because otherwise it's very hard to hear the difference. They sound very similar. Now in spelling they're different, but they sound very similar. So the here as well, if the Baal Kriya will not be careful to say them correctly, if he mixes up which is Ra'amses and which is Ra'meses, according to this opinion, that he would have to repeat the word. Now not everybody agrees to this, that they are two different places, but it's important to notice the subtle difference in the vowelization of the words, and that even vowels, even slight differences like this can change the meaning of the word. There are some, although few, there are some other examples in the Torah where this subtlety of whether a shiva should be pronounced or not pronounced can change the meaning of the word. This is a fun example. This is one that's easy to show people. But there are other places as well where you can point to differences in meaning based on whether the shiva is the beginning or end of a syllable. Question?
How did Goshen become Ramesses now?
It seems that Goshen is a section of Ramesses. Okay. That's what it seems.
I like that. I thought it was a city in Goshen. Goshen's not an area?
You think Ramesses is a city in Goshen?
No, not based on the other way.
I don't know. I'm just...
Well, let's think for a minute.
Because it's a
city. It says it's a
city. Oh, he says it's Meir Rashi's Meir, it's Goshen. Okay, you're right. So thank you.
So it's a city.
So it's the other way around. So Ramesses is in Goshen. Mm-hmm. It's a city or it's a section. Mm-hmm. Whatever it is. But it's one is part of the other. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes?
If the difference in pronunciation doesn't indicate a different place, what would it indicate?
Don't know. I don't know. Good question. I don't know the answer. Now, in Pasuk Yud Beis, back on 264, Some people really enjoy that kind of thing. Some people absolutely detest it. So we're moving on. On page 2, in yeshiva, I used to give a class in diktuk. It was a voluntary thing for anybody who wanted to come.
I was wondering how you found it, actually.
But this? I used to teach diktuk.
Because like, I wouldn't even know it. I'm obviously. You know.
No, this is I really enjoy this stuff. The ironic thing is, I was into this before, you know, when I was a baruch in yeshiva. When I got married, it happens to be my father-in-law, my wife's father, is a real expert in diktuk, much more than me. But that was, you know, luck of the draw. Anyway, so when I used to teach this in the yeshiva, there was a group of guys who were really interested in this stuff. They would come, but everybody else would say, "Oh yeah, it's the diktuk guys," you know. Like, yeah. So
Rabbi Kransky, give one here.
Yeah, give one here.
Some of us,
Rabbi Hiller
for women too.
Right, yeah. Rabbi Hiller really knows it a little more.
Rabbi Tendler used to get into it when he did Parsha Hashavua.
Rabbi
Tendler.
Okay. Now, Pasuk Yud Beis, verse 12. Vayechalkel Yosef es aviv es achav. We already read this, that Yosef supported or took care of his father and his brothers, Beis Kol Beis Aviv, and all the house of his father. Lechem lefi hatof, bread according to the children. So bread according to the children. So how much bread is that according to the children? So
maybe it means whatever people of any age would expect to eat.
Okay, depending on the age of the person. Could also mean according to family size. Right, so food was scarce, and Yosef would support his family, his father and his brothers. He would give them each according to the children, which means how many people are in the house. The more children in the house, then the more mouths there are to feed.
Mm-hmm.
So he would give more food. That's one explanation, that it would be based on family size. There is another explanation, which is said by a few different mefarshim, which I always like to say, which is that children, anybody who's ever tried to feed a child, a child old enough to eat real food, we know that children have big eyes.
Mm-hmm.
They will take large portions and then not finish it.
Just look at Kiddush.
Okay. So, but that's a natural thing for a child to do. Children do that. So Yosef here, understanding the nature of children and their need to have more on their plate, even though they may eat very little of it, gave enough food not only to support his family that they shouldn't starve, but enough that there should even be food for the children, meaning enough food to satiate the children's eyes, to have it on the plate. Many parents become very upset when children waste food, and obviously if money is scarce, then that's a very difficult thing to deal with. But the fact of the matter is, it's not wasteful to give a child more food than they're going to eat, because it is part of the satiation of a child to have that much on their plate. That's part of the eating experience for the child. And if it's known that that's what children do, that's a natural thing for a child to do. A child's not going against their nature when they take more food than they need. Obviously, there's limits to this, but that's what Yosef did. He fed the children. He gave enough food that the parents could feed their children even according to their big eyes. Pasuk Yud Gimel, verse 13. Now we begin, according to Rashi, a new discussion. And we're going to begin, though, with a subtlety that I have pointed out to you before. It is also a grammar subtlety, but we did mention this before, and you may remember it. We talked about it perhaps about 3 years ago. it should be clear as day.
That's right.
We'll remind you. Don't worry. And when I start talking about it, you'll say, "Oh yeah." Okay. It says, "V'lechem ein b'chol ha'aretz." There was no bread in all the land. Kichav ein hara av ma'od, for the famine was very heavy. Now, this phrase, "V'lechem ein b'chol ha'aretz," there was no bread in the land. It could have said, it could have said ve'ein lechem. There is no bread.
Mm-hmm. I just said the
Right, or yeah, well, it could have said yeah, it could have said ve'ein lechem or something like that. Rashi here tells us that we are now going back to the beginning of the famine. Remember, when Yaakov and his family came down, 2 years had already passed. Yosef sent a message to Yaakov that you should, when after he revealed himself to his brothers, that there are 2 years have passed in the famine, and there's another 5 years before there's going to be any harvesting, any planting or harvesting. If we turn back, I'll show you that pasuk. Back on page 254. Pasuk Yud Aleph, verse 11. It says, V'chil kalti oscha sham, I will support you there. Ki od chamesh shanim ra'av. Because there's still another 5 years of famine. And before that, let's see, before that he also said that there's 2 years to pass by. Back, yeah, one page earlier, 252. Pasuk Vav, verse 6. He says to the brothers, that the famine is in the midst of the land for these 2 years. There's another 5 years without any plowing or harvesting. So clearly, when the brothers came to Yosef, 2 years had passed. There were 5 years left. Rashi understands that Yaakov came down immediately to Egypt. There were still 5 years left to the famine. And so, from here on in, meaning from back on page 264, when it says there was no bread, it is not talking about the third year of the famine. Rather, it's going back to the beginning of the famine. Why? Because when Yaakov came to Mitzrayim, the famine ended, Rashi tells us. When Yaakov came to Mitzrayim, he walked over to the Nile. The Nile River overflowed its banks and irrigated all the fields, and things started to grow. And it was miraculous. Everybody knew that it was because of Yaakov. The problem that the Medrash that Rashi is using is trying to avoid is that if the famine ended after 2 years, wouldn't that prove that Yosef was wrong? Now, it's hard to prove Yosef was wrong because so many other things had gone exactly like he said. But here, it was so obvious that the bracha came because of Yaakov. And the famine ended after 2 years. The same Medrash says that after the death of Yaakov, the last 5 years of the famine were paid off. There was another 5 year famine after the death of Yaakov, which was the remainder that was not used during Yaakov's lifetime when he came to Egypt. Be that as it may, Rashi's understanding that this is a throwback to the beginning of the famine years. And we're going to go through now, according to Rashi, what happened during those first 2 years prior to the brothers coming to Egypt. Now, the point that is worthwhile knowing about how the Hebrew language works, at least biblically, is that we have, normally, you know, that when you translate Hebrew phrases into English, we change the subject and the predicate, the subject and the verb. You say, Vayidaber Moshe, and Moshe said. Now in Hebrew it says, and said Moshe. The verb, Vayidaber, precedes the subject, which is Moshe. Vayidaber Moshe, which literally means, and said Moshe, but we translated, and Moshe said, because in English we put the subject before the verb. That's the typical way to speak in English. So that's confusing when people begin to learn Hebrew, just to get that right. And usually people catch on pretty quickly, but it is somewhat confusing. Here, the Torah uses the subject first. V'lechem ein b'chol ha'aretz.
Where are we now on?
In Pasuk Yud Gimel, 13, on page 264. Back to where we are. I'm sorry. Back to where we are, page 264. It says in Pasuk Yud Gimel, V'lechem ein b'chol haaretz. Bread there wasn't in all the land. Ironically, here in English, we would use the verb first. There wasn't bread in all the land. But here the Torah puts the subject first. V'lechem ein b'chol haaretz. Rashi told us earlier, back in Parshas Bereishis, but again in Parshas Vayera, that when you see this form, then it does not mean there was no bread. It means there had been no bread. It is a throwback to an earlier time. And that's the way to translate this phrase. Not there was no bread, which is the way that the Stone Chumash has the translation. Now there was no bread in all the earth. Rather, Rashi would translate this as now there had been no bread.
Is it a little bit like as a reminder of the condition?
Well, it's not a reminder. It's telling us something about something that had happened previous to the story
right,
that we just said.
I mean, it recalls it's, to what has happened.
Yes.
Earlier.
Now, bear in mind the entire Torah is in past tense because it happened already. So we're being told the story, at least the story parts are in past tense because they happened already. So we're being told it in past tense. So all the phrases are in past tense. But they are meant to at least have somewhat of a storyline which appears to be chronological. But when you see a phrase like this, it's saying this part is out of order. This is, we're going back to something that happened before.
Like the past perfect in English.
Correct, the past perfect. Yes?
What would you say in Hebrew, there was no bread in the land?
Ve'in lechem. Okay. So, as I said, according to Rashi, we're going back. Now, not everybody's going to agree to this. But let's use Rashi at least first. So we have time. We'll explain how others read this. Read these series of psukim. So again, starting from Yud Gimel from 13, we're going to read a few now. V'lechem ein b'chol haaretz. There had been no bread in all the land. Ki chaved haraav me'od. For the famine was very heavy. Vateila eretz Mitzrayim eretz Kanan mipnei haraav. And the land of Mitzrayim, the land of Canaan, became worn out because of the famine. Vateila is a very powerful word. Just to be worn out, to be tired, to be exhausted because of the famine. So who had bread? Only Yosef. Vayelakit Yosef, and Yosef gathered as kol hakesef all the silver on nimtzab eretz Mitzrayim that had been found in all of the land of Egypt, uveretz Canaan and all the land of Canaan. Bashevra Hashem shovrim with the purchasing that they were purchasing. Vayavi Yosef as a kesef beisafaro. Yosef was very honest. He brought all the money to the house of Paro. Vayitom hakesef. Meretz Mitzrayim u'meretz Canaan, and the money was used up in all of the Mitzrayim and all of Canaan. There was no more money left. Vayavohu chol Mitzrayim el Yosef lemar, and all of Egypt came to Yosef saying, Havalanu lechem, give us bread. V'lama namus negdecha, and why should we die before you? Ki afes kasef, because there's no money. You have all the money. There is no money left. So why should we die? Vayomer Yosef, and Yosef said, Havu miknechem, give your cattle, your livestock, and I'll give to you for your cattle, for your livestock. I'll give you bread for your livestock. If there is no money, they brought their livestock to Yosef. And Yosef gave them bread for what? Basusim, for their horses, and in the sheep, and in the cattle, and for the donkeys. And he led them or fed them with bread for all of their livestock in that year. So that was the second year. Batitom hashanahahi, and that year ended. And they came to him in the second year. Vayomru lo, this would be the end of the second year, they said to him, lo nechached me'adoni, we will not lie, we will not hold back. How do they say it here? We will not, what's that?
Withhold,
okay, from our master. Kim tam hakesef, for the money has been used up, umiknea behema, and all of the livestock of animals, el adoni, to my master. Lo nishar lifnei adoni, there is nothing left in front of my master. Bilti im kviyosenu v'admasenu, except for our bodies and our land. Lama namus le'einecha, why should we die in front of your eyes? Gam anachnu, gam anmasenu, also us and also our land. Kenei osanu v'esanmasenu balachem, acquire us and our land for bread. And we and our land will be slaves to Paro. V'send zera and give seed. V'nichyeh v'lo namus, we will live and we will not die. V'ha adama lo seisham, and the land will not lay fallow. Will not be destroyed, lay in a desolate state. The fact that they're asking for seed is one of the things that Rashi points to prove the way he's learning, the way he's understanding this, because what are they asking for seed for? To plant the land. There's another 5 years left of the famine. Rather, there aren't 5 years left of the famine because Yaakov came and the famine ended. So the first 2 years, Yosef got all of the money and all of the livestock, and now at the end of the second year, the famine ends, but they don't have any seed. They have nothing. They have no way of planting, of sustaining themselves, even though the famine has ended. And so Yosef, so they say to Yosef, we will give you ourselves as slaves, and our land will become owned by the state, and we will essentially become serfs in order to give us seed so that we can plant the land. Vayiken Yosef es kol admas Mitzrayim lefaro. Yosef acquired all the land of Egypt for Paro. Ki machu Mitzrayim ish sadehu, for each man in Egypt sold his field. Ki chazak aleihem hara'av, for the famine was very strong upon them. Vatihi ha'aretz lefaro, and the entire land went to Paro. Okay, let's stop there. So Yosef here, the Torah is telling us his system for systematically taking control of all of Egypt. All the money, all the livestock, and finally all the land becomes owned by the crown. And Yosef is engineering, orchestrating this government takeover.
Why don't we rest? It's a communist country.
It's more than communist, mm-hmm. because they become serfs. They become serfs. Now, just to show you how systematic Yosef was, I saw that one of the Mefarshim understands that why did he take money first and then take the livestock? In fact, when he agrees to take the livestock, they offer it. They say, there's no money left, take our livestock. So Yosef says to them, excuse me, they don't even offer it. They say, there's no money, why should we die? So Yosef says to them, in Pasuk Tes Zion 16, back on 264, it says, I'll read it again, Vayomer Yosef, havu miknechem, give your cattle, your livestock, ve'etno lachem b'miknechem, I'll give it to you for your livestock, ima feis kasef, if there's no more money. Sounds like Yosef is saying, well, now that there's no more money, I'm willing to take livestock. Until now, I wasn't willing to take livestock. But now I'm willing to take livestock. So I saw one of the Mefarshim explains, Yosef did this deliberately. He knew that the longer they hold on to their livestock, the more food they need to feed it. Right. It's not enough to just get food for your family. You need food for your livestock as well. It will be more expensive for them to keep their livestock. If you would have taken the livestock first, it would have taken a longer period of time for them to use up their money. But because they had the livestock, and he wouldn't accept livestock as barter for the food, he would only accept money, it was very quick that they would run out of money. And then they needed to give something else. Now he took the livestock. So it was very calculated how he orchestrated the takeover of everything they owned. There are two opinions over here over whether the poor people ran out of money first and then the wealthy people, or did Yosef have a two-tiered system for pricing the food, that if a person was wealthy, then they were charged more money, and if they were not so wealthy, they were charged less money. It would have been presented as a way of helping the poor, as a welfare type of thing. However, in the end, everybody runs out of money.
At some time.
Yeah, nobody has any money left, including all the wealthy people. There's nothing left. They all become servants to Paro. And this is systematic for Yosef to do this. Why did he do this?
Well, they all become servants. If you don't have a hierarchy of different classes,
why do you want to get rid of the classes?
Give the people power so they can't, be against the Jews.
Okay. They can.
They won't have the power.
Okay. So Yosef has centralized the power. Mm-hmm. He centralized the power, which is under him.
Right.
So as long as he's alive anyway, the brothers are protected. That's true. But it's more than that. What was the prophecy? What was the covenant? What was going to happen to the Jewish people? They're going to be slaves. If everybody is a slave to Paro, it's a whole different system. It's not it's either it's more difficult for slavery to take place, or the slavery is in a different type of way. But everybody, in some way or other, is a servant to Paro.
So it doesn't look so bad.
Doesn't look so bad.
Well, they still enslaved them, though.
Yeah, they did. No, he knew they were going to enslave them. But he's trying to soften it.
So it's basically what he had done with the Brit Mila earlier.
Right. And he had them all.
So this way they couldn't stand out.
That's right. And in fact, let's read one more pasuk, just so we can finish this thought. On page 266, Pasuk Chafala, verse 21, Ve'es ha'am he'aviro so le'arim, and the nation, meaning the Egyptians, he moved them to cities, Mikzei gevul Mitzrayim ad katzeo, from one end of Egypt to the other. He moved everybody around. Didn't let anybody stay where their original land was. Now this is an intelligent thing to do, because if a family has owned land for generations, there's a family that's owned land for hundreds of years, and now they've given it to Paro. So how do you enforce the fact that it's no longer theirs? If you're going to let them stay on their land, for all intents and purposes, it's their land. They're going to claim it's their land. So you throw them off their land. You say, okay, it's no longer your land. You're not living here anymore. Go live over there. So he moved everybody around so no one could lay claim to their land. But more than that, Rashi says, it was in order to... What's that?
Everybody was strangers.
Right. Everybody was a stranger. The Jewish people were not the only ones who were in a new place, new surroundings, new schools, new everything, new jobs. It was now everybody was like that. Everybody in Egypt found themselves out of sorts, having to move.
Is that what Nebuchadnezzar did too?
Are you talking about Nebuchadnezzar or Sancheriv?
Yeah, Sancheriv. Who moved somebody around?
Yeah, Sancheriv.
All the Sancheriv. Languages.
Oh. Sancheriv did that. That's right. He moved everybody around. Yes. Okay. So this is Rashi's approach. So Rashi's approach is that we've gone back to the first 2 years of the famine, and at the end of the 2 years, the famine ends with Yaakov's coming to Egypt, and this was a description of those 2 years. The Torah tells it to us out of order. Why out of order? Because the Torah told us the whole story of Yosef and the brothers. We've gotten to the end of the story of Yosef and the brothers. It ends here with them coming to Egypt, getting settled in Egypt. When Yaakov comes before Paro, they're in Egypt. It's not really the end of the story of Yosef and his brothers. We're going to have more about them at the end of Parshas Vayechi, after the death of Yaakov. We'll still discuss this tension between the brothers. But it is the end of the Jews coming down to Egypt. The whole purpose of the whole story of Yosef and the brothers was to trace how we went from Eretz Canaan down to Egypt. Starting in Parshas Vayeshev, then Miketz, and Vayigash, we ended up in Egypt. So it's been a long story and a long discussion. A lot of it was very painful, but we've now traced the whole story. Now that we've traced the whole story, the Torah is saying, okay, let me tell you something about Yosef and the 2 years before the brothers came, which wasn't relevant to us for the storyline, but it is relevant to us to know about Yosef and what he did. So now we discuss the 2 years. That's the way Rashi understands it. Question?
You mentioned that when Yaakov came to Egypt, the famine ended. And you said that he touched the Nile?
He walked over to the Nile. I don't know if he touched it.
He walked over to... I've never heard that story. I mean, it sounds like one of the miracles, like versus the plagues. This is, he walked over to the Nile, and I've never, is it in...
The Medrash. The Medrash talks about
it.
Yeah.
As much as Yossi was trying to set these things on the ground, it still happened anyway. It was still strange, because later on they said the Pharaoh didn't know Yosef. So either was Hashem either hardened his heart, or was a different Pharaoh. So So
he knows it's going to happen anyway. No one can thwart HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Hashem makes it. But Yosef is trying to set it up as best he can. Mm-hmm. Yosef was given the position of supporting the Jewish people, of providing for the Jewish people. That was the position he got. He recognized that it's from Hashem, mm-hmm. that he placed him there in order to provide for his family. So Yosef is trying to do the best he can before he no longer has that position in order to set things up. The Gemara tells us that in the time of the Roman destruction of Yerushalayim, of the Beis HaMikdash, things were obviously very bad for the Jewish people. And by and large, the Roman leadership was very anti-Jewish. But there was one exception, that was Antoninus, who had a very good relationship with Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. And during his time, that's how the Mishnayos got compiled, because Antoninus made it easy for the Jews to get together, the scholars to get together to compile the Mishnah. During their relationship, Antoninus and Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, Antoninus provided, would smuggle all kinds of gold to Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. He couldn't be overt about it because the rest of the Roman leadership would have killed him for being so friendly with the Jewish people. But he secretly smuggled all kinds of gold to Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi was a very wealthy man, did not need that gold. So he said to Antoninus, "Why are you doing this? I don't need it. I'm wealthy, thank God, and it's not necessary." So Antoninus said to him, "Take it, because with this, your descendants will be able to, whoever takes over for you will be able to bribe whoever takes over for me." And he knew that this was not going to last. This was a blip in history, and he was aware that it was not going to last. So he told Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, "Take the gold, because you're not you, but those who come after you will make good use of it with those who come after me, who are not going to be as benevolent to the Jews." So they weren't blind to the fact. So Yosef, they all know that things are going to deteriorate, but they want to set things up as best they can to make it as easy as possible later. And that's what they're trying to do, which is the correct thing to do. Mm-hmm. It's the correct thing to do. HaKadosh Baruch Hu has plans, but our job is to do our hishtadlus, to do our effort in whatever we can to set things up, which is correct. Yeah.
What I don't remember the story, but what was the benefit of Antoninus having that friendship? I mean, they just liked each other.
It seems that it was in order the Mishnayos could be compiled. It seems that that's why Hashem allow that to happen. That's why Rashi explains
it.
I don't know if it was a formal conversion.
Okay.
Or if it was a formal conversion.
My brother said this Antoninus, that's so famous, that this was actually Mark Anthony.
Yeah, there's speculation of who he was.
It was Caesar's related to Caesar.
Yeah. Okay, now.
Antoninus was who? Did you say?
Mark Anthony.
Now, the other understanding over here is that this is not a throwback, that despite the language of Lechem Ein, despite the switching of the subject and the predicate, the verb and the noun, besides that really everything reads the way it seems. This is the Ramban's approach and others, and that in fact the famine went the entire 7 years. And that Yaakov did not come down until the end of the seventh year. That despite the fact that when Yosef sent word to Yaakov that there are 5 years left, but Yaakov did not come down immediately, or if he did, the truth is I don't think he discusses when Yaakov came down. If he did, no, excuse me, I take that back. He says it explicitly. Yaakov did come down during the famine. The famine did not end with Yaakov's arrival in Egypt. And when it says that Yosef supported or provided for his brothers and for his father, it was during the famine. You see, the way Rashi understands it, when Yosef provided for his father and brothers, it was after the famine. The famine was already over. But he still gave them bread that they wouldn't have to work for it. But according to this understanding, no, that Yosef did support his father and brothers during the famine. And the Torah here is discussing what happened over the course of time in the famine, and that it took a while for all the money to get used up, and then finally for all of the livestock to get used up. And so the last 2 years are being described over here. That it was the sixth year where the money became exhausted, and then they began with the livestock, and the livestock became exhausted in the seventh year, and then finally there was nothing left. The way they understand it is that when it says over here that that year ended, essentially the way the Ramban says is it took 5 years for the money to get used up, and then this is the last 2 years after that are being described. The sixth year, which was primarily livestock, and then seventh year, the rest of the livestock, and then of course their bodies and their land became property of the state of the crown of Paro. Another nuance to point out over here, which is worthwhile noting, that the emphasis over here throughout the discussion is the land of Egypt and the land of Canaan, that there was nothing left. There, everything was gone, that they used up their money, they had no food, etc. There is a discussion as to why are these two lands being specified? What about other lands? Was there a famine in other lands? It appears there was a famine in other lands, otherwise why go to Egypt?
There was no bread in all the earth.
Right. They could be understood to mean all the earth that was local. No, for sure it's all that was known. Mm-hmm. But that was local. There were other places besides Canaan and Mitzrayim. There was Bavel, or what is known as, at that time it wasn't called Bavel, but what is called Aram Naharaim, where Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, Leah were from. So there was Orkastim, there was Charan, there were other places. But it would seem that they didn't have bread either, because if they did have bread, why would everybody go to Egypt? Let them go to Charan for bread, which was equidistant. Why go to Egypt? So it appears that no place had bread. So why emphasize the land of Canaan?
Do we hear that any of them went to Egypt to get bread? I mean, to get food?
It says earlier, V'chol ha'aretz ba'o Mitzrayim. All the land came to Egypt. Seems like everybody was coming to Egypt, not just... There was Eretz Kush. Eretz Kush existed. There was Eretz Midyan. There were other places that were mentioned in the Chumash that had thriving civilizations at that time. And they also came to Egypt. So why are we emphasizing the land of Canaan and the land of Mitzrayim? So let me point out which pasuk to look at. In Pasuk Tes Vav, verse 15. So the Pasuk says, Vayitoma kesef me'eretz Mitzrayim u'me'eretz Canaan. The money was exhausted from Eretz Mitzrayim and Eretz Canaan. Vayavo'u chol Mitzrayim el Yosef leimor, and all Mitzrayim came to Yosef saying, Havalanu lechem, give us bread. V'lamanus namus negdecha, why should we die in front of you? Kiyo peis kasef, for there is no longer any money. So, again, one of the Mefarshim explains that the Pasuk tells us there was no money left in Canaan either, because had there been money left in Canaan, then the Egyptians would have had no leg to stand on with Yosef. Now they're saying to Yosef, why let us die? We don't have any money anyway. You're insisting we bring money. But there is no more money. So what do you gain by just letting us die of starvation?
Mm-hmm.
So give us another way of getting food. But had there been money in Canaan, Yosef could have responded, then what do you mean? I don't want to give food away for anything but money, because there's still money. There's still money in Canaan. So that's what he could have said. But because there was no money neither in Mitzrayim nor in Canaan, that's why they were able to say that, look, there's no money. There's nothing to gain anymore unless you have another way to barter for food.
Can the government just print some more?
What's that?
Just
print some more. Go ahead. Right.
I'm just thinking this, okay? If Joseph wasn't Jewish, if he was like a different leader, you know, if it wasn't for the Jewish people, I would think he's a terrible man. You know, depriving so many people of, you know, the money and the property and the cattle and eventually they had nothing but becoming serfs.
But they were going to die. It was either that or they die. You saved their lives?
Well, I'm saying if I would have been... there's a question of benevolence, having rachmonis on the people. So why is there? It seems like such a harsh. I'm not saying that
it was
didn't deserve.
It was
they were evil people or bad. I'm just.
It was orchestrated. It was deliberate. It was very calculated. He is deliberately doing this. He wants to set up a system where they are now serfs. That is the goal. That's why the Torah is telling us this to us. The Torah wants us to be aware of the fact that Yosef calculated the whole thing as he has done. You notice that we have seen Yosef plan. Yosef is an incredible planner. The whole system with the brothers, as we discussed over many weeks, how he has planned it all out and knowing what's going to happen the next step. It's a chess game. Mm-hmm. Here too, he's got it all planned out. Yosef is very calculated.
Do you hear what I'm saying? Like if he had done a different...
If there wasn't a good reason for what he did, it would be cruel.
Right.
Yeah.
So it just...
Right.
But he was trying to save Jewish people.
Now, the goal was not just save the Jewish people, but set them up. Set up the Jewish people in a way that was best for us. So that's what he does.
But, when you read the elders of Zion and all this, isn't that what they say?
They can say whatever they want.
But that's what they say.
They can say what they want. Look,
it's a hard argument.